This morning, I would like to reflect on Genesis 1, verse 22, where it says, God blessed the fish and the birds, saying, be fruitful and multiply and fill the waters and the seas and let birds multiply on the earth. And there was evening and there was morning, the fifth day. If my calendar and the cover of the bulletin is to be believed, today is August 18, slightly more than halfway through the month of August, and therefore slightly more than halfway through what is one of my least favorite months. Yeah, August is one of my least favorite months. It's not as bad as November, that cold and rainy and cloudy month headed towards winter. And it's slightly better than March, the month that Garrison Keillor used to say is the month God made so that people who don't drink can know what a hangover is like. Now, people readily understand my feelings about November and March, but are sometimes puzzled about August. And I really don't know how to explain it other than to say that August unnerves me. I used to think that it was the impending end of summer, the approach of school in September, and the imminent busyness of fall, but my feelings of dis-ease don't match that interpretation. You see, it's not anxiety that vexes me. Rather, August gives me the creeps. Some years ago, I went on a mid-August spiritual retreat to the Abbey of Gethsemane in Kentucky, the monastery where Thomas Merton was a monk. And it was there that I was able to finally put my finger on the very thing that disturbs me about August. And I wrote about it in the journal that I kept. And this is what I wrote. I've never thought about August as much as I have this year. It's a hot, sticky time, oversweet with smell, so full of memories it slides over towards a pained nostalgia. What strikes me is that things are just a bit too ripe. I don't mean overripe in the sense of past ripeness, rather too much ripeness. There's too much happening at once. On my walks outdoors, it seems that things are jumping out at you from all over. I've seen more species of dragonfly in the last 3 days than in my entire previous life. Or I'll be walking along and some bass droning insect will come bombing out of the undergrowth, scaring me half to death. You'd swear it was a deer fly, but who knows? It shoots by with a loud zzz, then silence for a second, then it zips by again. It gives me the creeps. The frogs up by the pond go zinging into the water, scaring the bejabbers out of me. And the undergrowth isn't any better. It's so thick that one could get lost 10 feet from the path. My shorts are the wrong clothes to make a foray into the brush. Anyway, I'd be scratched and clawed in no time at all. The smells are too jumbled to be detectable. August is a little bit too much. Strange, this seems to be what the activity of the year of creation points to. But I like the June and July of getting there a whole lot better than the August of having arrived. And I even like the September of having gotten there and beyond better than the August of just having arrived. So do you understand my aversion to August? How many of you swam to church this morning in the brewing heat and humidity? I once officiated a wedding in the Arboretum on August 6 at 5 p.m. It was 80 degrees and 95% humidity. The poor groom and groomsmen decked out in suits and white shirts were gushing sweat. I, of course, was calm, cool, collected. We were frantically trying to get the ceremony in before a severe thunderstorm rolled in from the direction of Celine. The poor musicians couldn't keep the violin and cello tuned in the humidity. The cello had one string that was a quarter pitch off. Paco Bell's Canon, indeed, does not sound good. A quarter pitch off. And I remember thinking, why would you have an outdoor wedding in August? And our garden, which starts out neat and relatively weed-free, is now a choked mass of undesirable plants on the verge of going to seed. The tomatoes all have tomato blossomed end rot. And without August, I wouldn't need to know what tomato blossom end rot is. So you know what I believe the problem with August is? The problem is that we get a glimpse of what God's blessing of creation with fruitfulness entails, and it's scary. Be fruitful and multiply and fill and teem, so God tells the fish and the birds on the fifth day of creation. By implication, God seems to have said it to the animals and insects on the sixth day as well. And it's a word to creation. Be lifeful. Multiply exponentially. Fill and teem and swarm. And here in Michigan, as elsewhere in the northern latitudes, it all comes home to roost in the month of August. August takes the divine blessing to the edge. And it's a miracle that we don't fall over into madness from the excess of it all. Now, I know this is a strange view of blessing. We like to speak of showers of blessing, as if God gently pitter-patters blessings in manageable doses upon human beings. But there's very little showery about the blessing of God's creation with fruitfulness, particularly in August. It's a deluge. And so, frankly, for every time creation amazes me and invigorates me with its beauty, it also makes me cringe and shudder a dozen times over with its excesses. I think back to high school. I ran cross country in Kalamazoo, Michigan, and we began practice at school in mid-August. And one of our workouts was to run half-mile repeats in a mown field behind the school. And those late August runs were always done through a sea of grasshoppers. Thousands upon thousands of grasshoppers swarming as we ran through the field. And as we ran, the grasshopper sea parted in front of us, clicking and clacking like the bow wave of a boat. And someone watching from a distance would have sworn the earth was erupting before us as those grasshoppers sprang out of the way. And when we finished each half-mile segment, we'd spend the first 10 seconds of our rest period brushing off the grasshoppers. So when I read the first chapters of Genesis, I'm impressed by many things about this creation. Its orderliness, its beauty. God starts out so meticulously. Light and dark are definitively separated into day and night. Earth and water and air are cleanly divided into land and ocean and firmament, each having their appointed place. God places sun, moon, and stars with such precision and regularity that we keep time by them. All these nice, orderly touches. This is the work of a managerial God, an attention to details God, a God who likes things in their proper place. And then the fifth day dawns, and God turns to creation with a maniacal glint in God's eye. He waves a magic wand over wind and waves and said, "Let the waters teem." And God implants a blessing, a divine principle of fruitfulness, of fecundity. And suddenly now there is a potency of life implanted within the creation through these words of blessing, and it means that creation is ready to break out in life at any moment and in any place. Creation now has a wild card. And so a managerial God gives way to a maniacal God, a God who delights in a creation ready to find the slightest opening, the slightest window of opportunity in order to get its foot in the front door. And I can attest to this from personal experience. My wife Sandy used to do quite a bit of traveling overseas, sometimes for as much as 10 days at a stretch. I was left at home in charge with our three children. And she would leave the refrigerator stocked and cleaned, and things would go well until about an hour before she came home. That was about when I decided it was time to clean the house. And I'd open the refrigerator door to make sure everything was in order. And the best thing that I could say is it was colorful. Reds and oranges and greens, a dozen different sorts of molds and bacteria. And the unfair part of it all is I didn't do anything. It wasn't my fault. It was the confounded blessing God said in chapter 1 of Genesis, and I'm the one who gets in trouble. Now let me shift voice just a bit. I think you realize I've been speaking somewhat tongue-in-cheek. August does unnerve me, but the lifeful zest of creation is, truth be told, one of the most fascinating things about living on this earth. I find it hard to imagine how one cannot come to love this earth, with its teeming oceans, its foul-filled air, its creatures great and small. I have been around for 62 Augusts, 62 cycles of warmth and cold, 62 cycles of creation's boom and bust. And I fall just a little bit more in love with this place each year. And I've come to realize that as followers of Christ, we commit ourselves to learning to love what God loves. And God must love this creation which God called forth out of nothing. Jesus encourages us to consider the lilies and the ravens. And what he literally says is, look at them. Really see them. See God's intimate connection to them and their welfare. But do we really see them? And so, as a first point of reflection, let me say that in religious communities shaped by the biblical tradition, we hear a lot about the blessing that God utters over humanity in Genesis 1, verse 28. How often do we hear about the blessing just a few verses earlier in almost identical language in which God blesses fish and fowl? It's interesting the way in which both Genesis 1:22 and 1:28 describe what God does. It says, God blessed them and said to them, be fruitful and multiply. It makes it sound as if God does two separate things. God blesses them and then says to them, gives them an order, do this. But the Hebrews loved repetition, which is why in the Psalms we find that the second line often repeats the idea of the first. And so I think these two verbs, that God blessed them and said to them, would be better understood if we translated it as God blessed them by saying to them. It really is a type of incantation that tells us that creatures, and not just us humans, but all creatures, will by their very nature be fruitful and multiplying types. And that it is God's deepest desire that all creatures share in this blessing, not just humans. And so our tendency, both personal and cultural, is to limit the blessing to only one of the three created arenas, out of sky, water, and earth. We limit it to land creatures and then further limit it to humans. And we fail to appreciate that God's fruitful intents are directed towards water and air every bit as much as to terra firma. We have come far, but we have so much farther to go to appreciate our place in the world and to acknowledge in humility it's not just about us. And a second point of reflection is that humanity has a tremendous capacity. And this is sad to say, but that humanity has tremendous capacity to turn blessings into curses and to sour the goodness of creation. And so for centuries we have attempted to eliminate, just wipe from the face of the earth, those species that we deem from a human perspective to be undesirable or unimportant or without value. We have figured that our wisdom is wiser than God's. We really don't need this. We can get rid of it. And so we wipe out the variety and we deconstruct complex ecosystems and we substitute boring and dangerous monocultures, and we don't realize what we are doing. We so alter things that we make the blessing difficult. Only opportunistic species can survive. So we stress streams with heat and land with chemicals, and then wonder why only a few species can survive, and those in unmanageable quantities. And there are times when I despair over humanity's ability to undo the blessing. Just think here in the Great Lakes region of how we turn the blessing of air and water into a curse. As someone who has biked along the shore of Lake Erie in late July and endured 40-mile stretch of smelling like I was biking through a pig farm and realizing that it was just the algae bloom in Lake Erie. It was a sad, sad bike ride. And these days, it seems like every day brings news of another assault upon or tragedy within the world of creation. Just this week, it was announced that the administration is weakening the Endangered Species Act. I don't get it. The news reports are of massive die-offs of salmon and sea mammals in Alaska and the Arctic due to record high temperatures. And this is with a government whose policy is to deny that there is such a thing as climate change. We have a refusal by the EPA this summer to ban chemicals that have been linked to human child development abnormalities and to the collapse of bee populations. I could do this for a half hour. I couldn't do it. I can't immerse myself in that. And you know, there is a downside to being ecologically aware, which I think Jesus' invitation to us to consider the creatures, that Christians ought to be ecologically aware because we love the creation as God does. But as Wendell Berry once wrote, to be ecologically literate is to be constantly reminded of the woundedness of the world. And in these times, it's also to be aware of the political and cultural madness that seemingly delights in making the wounds deeper and more deadly. But a third reflection on Genesis 1 is one that turns us to hope. Hope for a world that can thrive. Because the blessing that God implants, the divine magic, is irrepressible. And what is more, God has those who are on the side of the angels. Because being a person of faith entails having a commitment to keeping divine blessings a blessing, to being attuned to the goodnesses that God desires, as well as attentive to the ways in which, given time and attention, that blessing can reassert itself. And so, when the Christian community is politically and ecologically literate, when it knows how this plays out on the local level, what is happening in your watershed? Do you know what watershed you live in? Do you know where the things that you put on your lawn go when the next rainstorm hits? Seeing air as an arena of life, and then cultivating your love of the world, including its myriad creatures. My wife and I had the blessing of having our oldest grandchild live with us for the first 2 years of his life. We have a patio door out the back, and when we would feed him breakfast, we would take his high chair and we would turn it to the patio door. And so from floor to ceiling, he could see outside. And the world became his friend. When he was 1 and a half, he could pick out downy woodpeckers, and he would call them peck-pecks. And I remember once he said to me, "Cardinal." And I went and looked out the back, and at one of our feeders there was a flock of about 9 or 10 mourning doves. I hate to correct him, but I said, "Sorry, Shalom, those are mourning doves." And he says, "Cardinal." And I looked, and in the middle of that group of mourning doves was a female cardinal. Its color indistinguishable from the mourning doves, but only the shape of the beak and the crest on the head distinguished. And it points out to me the possibilities of cultivating, even at a very young age, a kind of wonder and love of this world and its myriad creatures. And so, wherever we can find a resonance with creation, we encourage it. And as Christians focus on the grace of God, to recognize that creation is every bit as much a work of God's grace as is salvation. We like to say the church is about grace, and that God's grace is everywhere. Well, if grace is defined as a free gift of God, unmerited and undeserved, without which life would not be possible, this creation is a primary manifestation of God's grace. So I invite you, as we move through the month of August, I invite you to be attuned to the edge of insanity to which God's blessing brings us. When you pick up your beach blanket, and there are 2 dozen mayflies clinging to it. Or when you take your morning walk through a neighboring park or woods, and you manage to clear out a dozen spider webs with your face in a quarter mile stretch. Or when you drop a slide of pond water under the microscope, and the realization sinks in that you have been swimming with all these creatures. Or when you open your refrigerator door and surprising colors reach you. Think of the blessing. And remember, your calling as a person of faith is to keep the blessing a blessing. To treasure God's grace wherever and in whatever form it is found.